Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. It's hard to imagine now, but 90 years ago, Ernest Hemingway was not yet a modern literary master. In fact, he hadn't even published his first novel. Living in relative poverty in what would come to be known as the Lost Generation era Paris, the young husband and father was on the cusp of greatness, but he needed a story. He found one in the Fiesta in Pamplona, one that came as a surprise to his cohorts, who later found thinly veiled fictionalized versions of themselves in the pages of The Sun Also Rises. These events are the subject of Leslie Bloom's compelling new book, Everybody Behaves Badly, the true story behind Hemingway's masterpiece, The Sun Also Rises. And it's my pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
When did you first encounter The Sun Also Rises?
I think I first read it when I was 13 or 14 years old. I mean, everybody gets introduced to Hemingway in middle or early high school. And it was the second Hemingway I read after Old Man and the Sea, and I was completely beguiled by the book, 1920s Paris, the entire scene. It just seemed so so wholly decadent. And I was also transfixed by Lady Brett Ashley, who is, you know, the central anti-heroine of the book. She was so glamorous but anguished at the same time, such a compelling character. The book stayed with me for a long time after I first read it.
And did you come back to it at some point?
It's one of those books that I reread every few years. I'm a Lost Generation obsessive, and I reread Gatsby also. And for me, those are the two seminal works of that era. And it means both of those books, but especially Sun Also Rises, means something different to me every time that I read it.
Do you think it's a book for young people? It's about young people and in their 20s and testing ideas about themselves out and so on. I wonder if you read it when you were around the same age Hemingway was when he wrote it.
Well, Hemingway, when he wrote it, he was in his mid-20s, which is a kind of astonishing when you think about it, because it's such a masterpiece, and it was such a revolutionary masterpiece. I reread it in my 20s, and I think when I read it in my teens, it seemed to me like it seemed as if what adulthood may have in store. And I think one of the reasons why The Sun Also Rises still has such appeal, I mean, it sells hundreds of thousands of copies around the world every year, is because it is such a handbook of the rebellious youth culture, but in a very glamorous sort of way also. And this was one of the first mass marketed works of fiction in which that kind of thing was exhibited, that kind of youthful rebelliousness. And before The Sun Also Rises came out, you know, the youth culture in the 1920s was really being led by F. Scott Fitzgerald. It was the jazz age, it was champagne, it was dancing, it was the Charleston. But when The Sun Also Rises came out, on the other hand, it was really much more dissipated. This was a lost generation, Hemingway told his readers, and it was more about rebellion, questioning institutions, and trying to find meaning in institutions that may have been shattered, in his opinion, by the First World War.
Well, let's get back to Fitzgerald in a bit, but I wonder, how did you get started on this project, sort of investigating the story behind the story?
Well, I was actually researching a different project when I came across a picture of Hemingway sitting with an entourage of comrades at a cafe in Pamplona in 1925, and sitting next to him was a very fetching woman, and I was drawn to her, and I did a little bit of research, and I saw that she was named Lady Duff Twisden, and she had been the real-life inspiration behind Lady Brett Ashley, and I hadn't known that there was such a vibrant real-life story behind The Sun Also Rises. So I started to look for, you know, a single book that would compellingly tell me the backstory of the real life events that inspired Sun, and I didn't find it, and it was frustrating. So I wrote it myself.
That was kind of a major source of tension in Hemingway's literary circles after the book came out, because many of them charged him with, you know, merely being a journalist in writing down the events of the festival the year before. What do you make of that? I mean, is experience fair game for what's being billed as a groundbreaking novel?
Well, I mean, most people write from life. I mean, maybe not as literally as Hemingway did in the case of The Sun Also Rises. I mean, he really very literally lifted events that took place in Paris and Pamplona and transcribed them into literature. And also, there are very few characters, major characters or incidental characters in The Sun Also Rises that are purely fictional. I mean, he literally lifted the backgrounds of the main characters to a way that almost seems libelous. But, you know, they were under pseudonyms, so it didn't matter. I mean, in the first drafts of The Sun Also Rises, these people actually appeared under their own names. So it was pretty astonishing, you know, but all of the principals had different opinions about how they had been used in the book. I mean, some were aghast and some couldn't believe that Hemingway was even passing off the book as fiction. And then, you know, another one of the main characters, real life characters, said, well, look, you know, I mean, this was just a leaping off point. Hemingway was an artist. He wasn't a diarist. So opinions did vary. I think, you know, you would be really hard pressed to find a work of major literature that came entirely from imagination. But this was very literally a roman à clef.
Can you take us through a few of the characters and tell us, you know, what their names are in the book and who they were in real life? If people have read The Sun Also Rises, they'll probably recognize a few of the names.
Well, there are so many that are real characters. So, you know, Ernest Hemingway was the primary inspiration behind Jake Barnes, who is the protagonist of the book, and he has a famous wound. He is, I don't know if I can say this on the air, but he is impotent. And Hemingway drew on his own wartime experiences. He had a shrapnel accident when he was serving as an ambulance driver and in the First World War. And he saw other military comrades and ambulance drivers who had been wounded in that way. And he took that idea for the wound and applied it to Jake Barnes. Even though he himself had not been rendered impotent, it almost happened to him. And it allowed him to create a perfect observer because he literally couldn't, you know, participate. And then we have Robert Cohn, who is one of the main characters. He is Hemingway's tennis friend, as Jake Barnes describes Cohn in the book. And in real life, he was Harold Loeb, who, like Cohn, was the heir to two, or was an heir to two of New York City's most wealthy and prominent Jewish families. A Princeton graduate like Robert Cohn. And Hemingway really very literally lifted Harold Loeb's biography to create the character. I think, you know, one of the only changes, in fact, was that he said that Cohn was a boxer when, in fact, Harold Loeb had wrestled at Princeton. That was the biggest concession he was willing to make in terms of covering up. And then, of course, we have Lady Duff Twisden, who was the main character behind Lady Brett Ashley, you know, who is one of the most compelling and glamorous female characters in modern literature. And again, Hemingway literally lifted her background. I mean, she had inherited her title from a previous marriage. She was in Paris sitting out a divorce, and Hemingway, in a later discarded passage of The Sun Also Rises, gave her background, Twisden's background, in such literal detail, prescribing it to Brett, that it was pretty breathtaking. I mean, the only change he made there was that, I think in real life, her husband, Twisden's husband, had been a ninth baronet, and Hemingway made it a tenth baronet. I mean, it was just, it just literally was transcription. And I was told by his son that he had, quote, a rat trap memory, and this was one of his best assets. And so Hemingway clocked a lot of time with the real life with the prototypes in cafes, listening to their life stories, and it might have been casual chat for them, but he was, you know, remembering, he was filing away all of this information. And at one point he, you know, wrote a letter to Ezra Pound and said that he was in the possession of a valuable piece of gossip. I mean, he recognized the value of gossip in these testimonies and then would later translate them into character backgrounds.
What was his life like leading up to the writing and publishing of this novel?
Well, Hemingway, when he first turned up in Paris, as one of his friends said, he was still a nobody, and he wanted very badly to be a somebody. And this was not a pursuit of empty fame in the way, you know, like a reality TV kind of thing. I mean, there was a nobility to the aspiration, because he wanted to revolutionize literature. He wasn't the only one who wanted to, but he really wanted to participate in that. But in those early days, nobody was buying the short stories of Ernest Miller Hemingway. He just could not break through. It was incredibly frustrating to him. He came over as a journalist. He was writing for the Toronto Star, a lot of atmosphere stories, and on Paris, he was really good at it, a little acidic. And also for the wire services. But I mean, it was taking, he was so good at it that his editor started sending him all over Europe, and he didn't have time to do the serious writing that he wanted to do. So then when he quits, the journalism to concentrate exclusively on the writing, he's poor. And he and his wife and his now little son had to subsist on a modest trust fund that she had brought to the table. But they really struggled. I mean, they were all making sacrifices for him to have the career that he wanted. And he felt badly about it. I mean, he would look at his poor wife who had holes in her shoes. She was walking all over Paris looking for bargain food. Rumors went around that, you know, their baby slept in a dresser drawer. And he said, you know, poverty is not, it's harder on the person who's not getting gratification from your work. And he was getting gratification from his work. He just wasn't selling it. And soon it became imperative that he sell it. And that's when things get interesting, because he really was the driving force behind his own publications. He had an enormous amount of help, but he was incredible at making and leveraging connections. And his ambition during this time seemed limitless.
I said we would bring Fitzgerald back into the picture. Seems like a good time to do that now. Much of your book is about that race to retain a publisher and to get that first novel out there. He would later score settle quite savagely in some cases in A Movable Feast, mm-hmm. Which was published after his death. But Fitzgerald turns out to be a real sort of silent ally. How did he end up getting a publisher for this book? And I guess there was one that came out just a little bit before it.
Well, I mean, Fitzgerald, he wasn't a silent ally. He was a pretty vocal ally. And even before Hemingway had any idea that Fitzgerald was an ally. And one of the things that astonished me in my research was how important novels were there, and how successful novels were major celebrities in their day. So when Hemingway was trying to make his breakthrough in the early 20s, Fitzgerald was a huge international celebrity from 1920 on. He had started with This Side of Paradise, and he was at Charles Scribner's Sons, which was a prestige publishing house in New York City. So Fitzgerald comes across a few years later some of Hemingway's work called In Our Time, and he sends it to his editor unsolicited. I mean, Hemingway has no idea. He sends it to his editor at Scribner's, Maxwell Perkins, and says, "This guy is the real deal. You should keep an eye out for him." So in the meantime, all the publishers at that time knew that Paris was sort of a hot seat of innovation. They were all sending their scouts over trying to find material. And so Max Perkins tries to get in touch with Hemingway, and he can't at first. I mean, he doesn't have a reliable address for him, and finally gets him a letter through Sylvia Beach at Shakespeare and Company and says, you know, I'm really interested in seeing more of your work. And Hemingway, unfortunately, has just signed with a publisher who he doesn't really want to do work with. But at that point, it's too late. So they have to connive his way back into Scribner's at some point. But Fitzgerald is the one who paved the way for Hemingway. And when Hemingway finds this out, they do eventually become close friends. And the correspondence between them during this time reveals a real affection, no matter what Hemingway was saying about him to other people or what he would say about him later on. I mean, it was a real collaboration between two men who were very serious about the craft of writing, and Fitzgerald encouraged Hemingway. And later, when Hemingway actually did write the manuscript for The Sun Also Rises, Fitzgerald gave him incredibly valuable advice on editing, which actually turned it from, you know, a draft to a polished possible masterpiece. And he did more editing on the manuscript than Hemingway's actual editor, who by that time was Maxwell Perkins at Scribner's.
We're speaking with Leslie Bloom, the author of Everybody Behaves Badly, the true story behind Hemingway's masterpiece, The Sun Also Rises. Perkins had to fight pretty hard to get the book published at Scribner's, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, Scribner's was in many ways was an unlikely ally for Hemingway in the way that he had been an unlikely ally for Scott Fitzgerald or Ring Lardner. He was a quiet guy. He was from, you know, Puritan New England stock. But he also had kind of a daredevil side to him. He had been a journalist before he had gone into publishing and always volunteered himself for these crazy assignments. I think he let himself get strapped to an electric chair for a story, or, you know, he was always racing around in cars, one of which went up in flames. So he had a real sensibility for vox populi tastes. And as one of my sources told me, I mean, he would have been a great editor at Vanity Fair also. But there was something Max Perkins recognized in a way that other people at Scribner's did not, that World War II had changed everything. And they had hugely popular writers, Edith Wharton, Theodore Roosevelt, Henry James. But these guys were starting to seem passé to the post-war youth generation, and he knew it. And he, you know, when Fitzgerald first came to him with came to the house with a manuscript, Perkins was the one who pushed that through, even though This Side of Paradise scandalized some of the older editors. And he told Scribner, and he told, you know, the other editors, that they had to move with the times or they might as well hang up their hats. But still, every time a new potentially controversial manuscript that came into the house, he would still have to fight for it. Now, The Sun Also Rises, when it came in, it kind of made This Side of Paradise pale in comparison. I mean, Lady Brett Ashley was, you know, arguably one of the more dissolute characters who was, you know, in the landscape at that time. I mean, she made Daisy Buchanan and Gatsby look chaste, and you know, there were four-letter words. I mean, it was a naughty and shocking book at the time, and he had a harder fight on his hands than he did with This Side of Paradise. But he made his case, and Charles Scribner, the elder, listened to him, and everybody cautiously got behind it. I mean, the argument that you have to move with the times or go away just really resonated. And once Perkins did get the manuscript pushed through, everybody got behind it. I mean, it really was a very heavily backed book by Scribner's. The PR team was insane about The Sun Also Rises and Ernest Hemingway. The marketing team went really to the furthest reaches to bring the book to the masses. So it became a collective gamble, even though it had initially been Max Perkins's gamble.
I won't ruin the great epilogue in your book for people who want to know what became of everybody, but in general, the stars of this book, the real people that the characters were based on, didn't have a heads up from Hemingway that this was coming out. How was it received by them, and how did it affect their lives in the decades to come?
Well, Hemingway was a little bit naughty when he was writing this book. I mean, he was in constant touch with some of the real-life characters who he was writing up, you know, under fictional guise. I mean, in sort of teasing them as he was writing it. You know, I'm working on a great novel. It's going to be a hell of a book. I mean, he even had, you know, Harold Loeb, who was, you know, pretty much savaged in his portrait as Robert Cohn, advocating for him in New York. But you know, declined to tell them. I mean, he did let the news slip at a casual dinner in Paris with some of the prototypes, and he said, you know, perhaps after, you know, drinking too much, I'm writing a novel and I'm tearing these bastards apart, is what he told one of the people in attendance, and indicated some of the other people at the table who were about to appear as Sun Also Rises characters. So that was a shot across the bow. So, I mean, that may have started to make some people nervous when they got a sense that he really was writing a roman à clef. But then none of them got advanced copies of the book. They weren't given, you know, any kind of warning at all. They just read the book along with everybody else on two continents when the book came out. And believe me, there were a lot of red faces. One of the women who was written up in the book as Frances Klein, who was a desperate aging girlfriend of Robert Cohn. I mean, she said she couldn't get out of bed for 3 days. You know, it was said to give people ulcers. There were rumors that, you know, they were looking for Hemingway with guns. I mean, it was really quite scandalous. It made the gossip columns as well as, you know, all of the serious, you know, hardcore literary reviews. And the bottom line was that the portraits of these people, they affected them for the rest of their lives and beyond. I mean, you're hard pressed in cases where these people did have obituaries in major publications. All of them mentioned the fact that they were prototypes for The Sun Also Rises. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, their coverage of their later lives exists only because they were used in this way. And one of the characters said, you know, that The Sun Also Rises created a demarcation in all of their lives. Life became known as BS, which was before Sun, or AS, which was after Sun. So the novel really did alter life for all of them, but nobody more than Hemingway, because the novel made him into a superstar.
What about this business of the lost generation? Hemingway had come to study at the feet of Gertrude Stein. That relationship obviously didn't last much longer, but how did her quotation end up sort of setting the tone for the rest of the book?
Yeah, Hemingway was mentored by Gertrude Stein, who taught him a lot about repetition of language. And you really start to see, he was interested in this sort of thing before he met her, but after, you know, she started giving him, you know, lessons, you really start to see his work go in a very rhythmic direction. The relationship kind of petered out pretty quickly. Hemingway was not known for staying on great terms with his former mentors, Gertrude Stein included. But by when he wrote The Sun Also Rises, he was still on good enough terms with her to apparently have had a conversation where Gertrude Stein said to him that she had been at a garage recently and that the garage owner had been lamenting the fact that he could not get good help among young people. He said they are all the people who were in the war. They were all a lost generation. And, you know, Gertrude Stein, in turn, told Hemingway, according to his recounting, that, you know, that applied to Hemingway and his whole generation, too. Anybody between, you know, the ages of 21 and 27 were just lost. So this resonated with Hemingway, and he lifted it and decided to apply it to his own work. And originally, The Sun Also Rises had a lengthy foreword called The Lost Generation, which was a considered title for the book. And until that point, The Sun Also Rises really was sort of a tell-all about a lot of really quite bad behavior in Paris and Pamplona. And it could have just been seen as sort of a naughty book about the antics of, you know, the well-educated and, you know, with some society thrown in. But the addition of the lost generation, you know, that these are people who, you know, are badly behaved because the war ruined them, because it ruined religion, it ruined all the institutions that give people guidance. Were shattered. So when he put them in that context, all of a sudden it elevated all of the material. This was not bitchy gossip. This was a real serious cultural commentary, and it was an ingenious move on Hemingway's part. Now, he eventually eliminates the foreword that explains the origin of the phrase "the lost generation," and he just replaces it in perfect Hemingway style with a quote from Gertrude Stein at the top of the book, and it just simply says six words: "You are all a lost generation." And that's all he needed to do. And that, combined with a passage from the Bible, which explains the sun also rises, elevated the material into high literature.
As a writer, as an author, did Hemingway rub off on you at all as you were working on this project?
Yeah, I mean, Hemingway is arguably the most insidious influence, you know, ever. I mean, even Fitzgerald complained about that. I mean, Fitzgerald could not have had a more different style than Hemingway. I mean, Fitzgerald's was still quite a 19th century style. And even he said that after, you know, being in proximity to Hemingway's work, that it was just hard to shake it off. And it has been said that, you know, after Hemingway, you know, all the writers that emerged after that either had to, you know, either wrote like him or were trying not to write like him. But either way, he was the standard. You know, in my own writing, I'm a journalist, and, you know, I operate, you know, on a lot of the same principles that he does in terms of, you know, writing stories. And he, you know, any time, you know, you aren't putting a comma in or something, you're like, am I doing this because, you know, Hemingway has influenced me? And influence it's relentless, and it's not a bad influence to have, but it's an obvious influence to have. And so you really have to, as a writer, make a decision about how you're going to position yourself against that very powerful spare style.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you, maybe it's just because it's summer, but I was thinking about when you watch Jaws, the shark is scary. When you see how they made the shark, it's not scary anymore. And did you worry at all that you would undercut the magic of the novel by your research?
I think that the novel actually became 1,000 times more magical to me once I saw how the sausage was made, because any time I feel like that there's a true story behind something, it adds an element of fascination. And just to see how Hemingway actually used this material, and to see him imbue the material, again, a lot of, you know, very bad behavior, but imbue it with such a nobility of purpose, was very interesting. The Sun Also Rises isn't just a portrait of the times. It's also, Hemingway used the material to bring to a commercial readership modern literature for the first time. I mean, other people were trying to do that, But they didn't have a commercial following. I mean, nobody read Gertrude Stein's books. Ezra Pound isn't going to sell a million copies of Acantos. But Hemingway is taking all of their lessons, and he's applying it and to this material. And all of a sudden, I mean, you have, you know, a quite, in The Sun Also Rises, you have quite a juicy read that can be read across all demographics. The more I learned about it, the more ingenious I thought it was, and the more I realized it, how significant the work was, in a way that I feel like The Sun Also Rises is actually quite undersung. People tend to really exalt A Farewell to Arms deservingly, but I mean, The Sun Also Rises really did so many, had so many achievements, and so I am grateful to have been given the opportunity to have the inside glance.
Last question. It's almost July. Will your book tour bring you to the Festival of San Fermín?
Unfortunately, this time around, I'll be landlocked in the States, but I do intend to go to the Running of the Bulls next year. I believe that one of the networks is sending a correspondent to the Running of the Bulls to show the background of Everybody Behaves Badly. I have been to Pamplona. I have not been to the Running of the Bulls. Women are actually not allowed to run with the bulls.
Still?
Still. And
Men shouldn't be either, frankly.
I mean, it looks pretty scary. I mean, it's, you know, I'm a little too cowardly to face down a 2,000 pound animal with razor sharp horns. I think Hemingway might have disapproved of me for that, but that's just a chance that I'll have to take.
Well, we've been speaking with Leslie Bloom, and the book is Everybody Behaves Badly, the true story behind Hemingway's masterpiece, The Sun Also Rises. I'll just say, Leslie, that I loved both books, and it was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Truly appreciate it.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.